Hello everyone and welcome back to the NBL Pocket Podcast. Small break in between, two podcasts in one day. Boddy and I got together and recorded this episode post the decision by the NBL. That's pretty common knowledge at this point. Wildcats win the championship, Bryce Cotton, finals MVP. In this conversation we talked about St Kilda in the early 70s, about what happened there, about when they sort of had to forfeit a grand final of sorts. We talked about the result, Rule 34, and the rules around the abandonment of a game and how this decision was arrived at by the league. And we talked about Cotton, whether he was finals MVP, but who else was perhaps in that conversation, and also who was the best king in this series. We also spoke about the king's decision, whether Boddy thought that was interesting, fair, unfair, what have you. Really hope you enjoy it. And as always, rate, review, and subscribe.
It's basketball. It's not a f***ing soft sport.
I love it, Gabe. I love it.
First thing I wanted to talk to you about, Boddy, is didn't a similar thing like this happen with St Kilda many years ago? I sort of saw John Casey put out a tweet. Can you tell me what happened in that instance?
Okay, that was in 1981. St Kilda had won the regular season championship. And in Brazil, there was going to be the first World Club Championship in Rio, I believe. Anyway, Australia's champion at that time was St Kilda, but unfortunately, the dates of this World Club Championship clashed with the finals of the NBL. Now, at that stage, the NBL's attitude was a little bit different to what it is now, in as much as St Kilda had come through the 70s alongside Melbourne Church, who are now Melbourne Tigers, as the two dominant teams in Australian basketball. And Melbourne at that time wasn't in the NBL, and St Kilda continued its dominance, winning in 1979, the inaugural season, winning again in 1980, and being quite some distance ahead as regular season champion in 81. So they would have won it again. There's no question about that. Anybody who saw that season knows that St Kilda was miles apart from the rest of the field, would have won three in a row. So the NBL basically said, no, look, you can accept that. Go to the World Club Championship. And at that stage, we didn't know whether that was going to be an ongoing event. There was a presumption there would be an ongoing event every 4 years or every 2 years. So St Kilda was going to the inaugural one. Off they went, and they vacated the finals to go to that tournament. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, the NBL said, okay, they're gone. They're out. We'll just go teams finishing 2, 3, 4, 5. Will now play off instead of 1, 2, 3, 4 for the championship. And as history shows, Launceston Casino City got up, won that championship, and there's never been an asterisk next to that. But St Kilda absolutely was by far the best team, but at that stage the league, I recall, did not want them to win three in a row. So this came up and it was convenient. It was a political decision at the time. No question. And it cost St Kilda. If you sat down with Brian Curl, who was the coach of the St Kilda team at that stage and would have won his third championship, it's still something that grates and irritates. Mm-hmm. Yeah, even today, some, 40 years later. Because the NBL could have manipulated things to allow them to play, but chose not to.
Right. Well, did that St Kilda team go to Rio sort of not knowing, or knowing they were forfeiting
They knew that by going, they would not be winning the NBL championship because that would go on without them. But they were representing.
There was no leniency. It was a one-off grand final at that stage, right?
That's right.
Probably could have, it's not a five-game series. You probably could have orchestrated that, especially
It was conducted over a weekend, so you had 1 versus 4 in a semi and 2 versus 3 in a semi. Oh, right. I think that was on the Friday or the Saturday, and they played the final on Sunday in Adelaide, as a matter of fact. Mm. And that's where Launceston Casino City knocked off the Ngunnawal Inspectors, if I'm not mistaken. And, St Kilda really would have beaten all four of those teams and probably on consecutive nights. So, basically they were allowed and encouraged to represent Australia.
Yeah,
this first World Club Championship. And what happened was There was no subsequent World Club Championship, so that was a one-off. They in fact, then forfeited the chance to win a third NBL championship in a row, which they deserved. They were the best team in the country by a country mile. And their superstar import, Rocky Smith, who would be remembered now had he stayed more than the 2 years that he played, as one of the all-time greats and whose name would be in the same conversation as Leroy Loggins and Andrew Gaze, who are the main guys in our history, in the NBL history. What happened was Rocky Smith, he played so well at that tournament that a Brazilian team made him an offer that he couldn't refuse, and we never saw him again. So it cost St Kilda the NBL championship, and it cost him the best import that we'd seen to that stage.
When it rains, it pours, especially in Rio. How about that?
There you go.
You obviously saw the press conference.
Yes.
What did you think of the tone of it and Larry and Jeremy, as them as people and managers of the league?
I thought they handled it very well. This is really a no-win situation, even though Perth Wildcats have won out of it. It's the circumstances of our world and our universe as we know it right now. We haven't seen anything like this in more than 100 years, not since the flu outbreak after the First World War, in 1918, more than 100 years. So nobody living today has experienced what we're going through with this COVID-19 coronavirus thing. So it's just everybody's making decisions on the fly. And I think they sat down, they weighed it up, and they made the correct call, because I'm also of that mindset that you've played more than half of this best of five series. You're over halfway. It's that analogy about the racing analogy, that if you know you've done it more than half the laps and the race is called, the winner is the winner, who's leading. So I have no problem with it. I don't take away any validity from that championship, because Perth did it hard. Yeah. They had to play Sydney in front of 12,000 people. Never got that benefit of having the calls and everything else influenced by that crowd, because crowds do influence the umpiring, no question. And we saw it when game two, when there was no crowd, and suddenly Perth Wildcats got called for 10 more fouls than Sydney Kings, 25-15 in that game, which has never occurred ever. They've been at RAC Arena for the better part of 7 years. So then they went back to Sydney and in front of no crowd, won comfortably. So they beat Sydney in front of a crowd, which they never had the benefit of in their middle game. And then they beat Sydney in front of, you know, family and friends. So I don't take away anything from the Perth Wildcats. I think that this was a very sound decision. It was a gutsy decision and a decision made by a leader at a time when we're seeing leaders, you know, all walks of life act like squibs, unable to make a decision, weak as the perennial piss. And these guys sat down and made a really, really good call. Made a good call. Look, it's not going to be popular. Sydney Kings fans are going to hate it. And we'll be blasting it forever. But the reality is, if you're, as I said before, I don't have a dog in this fight. So I'm just looking at it from the outside and thinking, what would have been the best course? And that's what I thought it was. So I'm in complete agreement with it. Also with Bryce Cotton as the MVP.
Yeah, no doubt. What I wanted to, going quickly back on that, people were sort of criticizing the 48-hour delay between calling off the series and then coming to this conclusion. To me, that seems I love deliberation. I don't think you can sit and thought, you can sit and thought too long, but there is a sweet spot. And I think they found the sweet spot here where they went through this, and the way they went through this press conference, and I wrote down a few things, you know, rules are rules. Very squarely, we came to this outcome. They quoted rule 34 of the rules of the governing, the abandonment from the handbook. So they got professional advice from, you know, 1, 2, 3 sources, that they took a range of influence and came to this result. So I don't think you could have done it any prudently, any better, any more respectfully of either team. I was really impressed. Absolutely. Yes. But you didn't have a problem with the deliberation time of 48 hours?
No, not at all. Not at all. No, I'm with you, in as much as this is a very important decision, short term and long term, on how we view our league as well. And so it wasn't one where you can just go, oh, okay, no, we'll just make a decision. We're going to have joint, you know, winners, or we're going to just, they had to sit down, they had to work through it. And as far as I'm concerned, they came to the 100% correct decision. So I don't have an issue with it.
I haven't read
not at all.
I haven't read Rule 34, but Jeremy Loliga and Larry Kesselman said that was a rule that particularly pertained to abandonment of a game. So my question to you, Boddy, is do you feel from Tuesday when the Sydney Kings had their press conference, Pongrass, Weaver and Smith, do you feel like their words and the way they went about it, do you feel like they abandoned this game four and indeed the series? Would you use that word abandon?
Well, I think they made the call that they thought was correct. All right. And that's as much as I can say to that, because we still don't know what the long-term outcome of this whole coronavirus thing is going to be. So they made a call that they thought was prudent and correct, and I'm not going to be critical of them for doing that.
Right.
A lot of people have said, you know, would they have played the games if they were 2-1 up? And
no, that's not.
And all this sort of stuff. So, yeah, a lot of nonsense starts to pour into it. I'm just going to take them on face value and say that I think they did what they thought was right for their organization.
Yeah.
Whereas, I was going to say, whereas the Wildcats were sort of more about, let's get this done. Let's get this done. Let's find a way to get it done. Let's play it in Adelaide. Let's charter planes. Let's change the dates. Let's do whatever, you know. Well, maybe they were
Wildcat by name, Wildcat by nature. They and I'm going to quote something that I very great quote. It said, actually, I've got it written here. It said, when one can see no future, all one can do is the next right thing. Do you like that, buddy?
Yeah, I do. Who said that?
We said that. That was the troll from Frozen 2. Have you seen Frozen 2?
No, but my girls love it. So
yeah, and I just thought that summed it up. I thought, wow, uncertain times. And the Wildcats were like, okay, an uncertain future, but we're just going to do the next right thing, which is we're basketball players and a basketball team. We're going to play out this series safely. And that was their mission, and that was pretty obvious from their press conference. And I don't think – did you begrudge them their tone at all?
No, not at all. I didn't begrudge Sydney the way they went about it, and I don't begrudge Perth saying, you know, we want to play this thing, we want to get it done, and we want to be declared champs. I don't begrudge either of them. They had their own viewpoints, and I tend to agree with the Wildcats' position, obviously, because I support the NBL's decision. But that's not to say that I'm wanting to be critical of Sydney. I don't particularly want to be critical of them, but they made a choice, and I think. In the what rule are we quoting? Are we quoting Rule 303? We took the Boers out and we shot the bastards. Oh no, sorry, that's breaking my rant. I don't know what happened there. Sorry.
Shoot straight. what was I going to say? I think the Kings preference. I think they made a decision, but you know it came with a heavy cost for them and a heavy heart, I'm sure. But that's the breaks. Going back to Finals MVP, obviously Cotton. Do you have any doubt at all that he shouldn't have been Finals MVP?
None whatsoever. 30 points a game, 4.7 assists. I think that the only person that would have challenged him for it would have been his teammate, Nick Kay, who also had a very good series. And I think the two of them actually were quite responsible for the position that the Wildcats found themselves in. Other than that, you know, Andrew Bogut had a good game one, a good game two. Lish had a good game two, good game three. You know, there are other people. But I thought Bryce was the standout, and next in his shadow would have been Kay. So, no, I have no issue with that whatsoever.
Who do you think, let's say, negating the Wildcats, pushing them to one side, if you had to give a finals MVP for exclusively the Sydney Kings, one of their players, who would it be?
Probably Kevin Lish.
Yeah, that would be my answer too. Why do you say Lish?
Because I think he came through when they needed him to, and he would have done more if he had been on the floor at times when he should have been. I think they have themselves to blame for the situation they found themselves in terms of the games. I'm not talking about
being down 2-1,
what's happened subsequently. Yeah, and being down 2-1, I think if you're going to substitute that way, I think I said on the Brad and Boddy podcast that I felt that Will Weaver's substitution pattern was consistent with a NBA G League coach.
Yeah.
More so than someone that's trying to win a championship here. Like in the G League, there are guys there trying to get 10-day contracts, trying to get noticed by the NBA. And part of your job as a coach in that league is to give them that opportunity to get on the floor and show what they can do with the goal of going somewhere higher. And so I've no doubt, you know, I haven't seen what his substitution patterns were like with the Long Island Nets, but presumably very similar. But I don't think you can do that here. And I don't think when you're trying to win a championship, you've got to go, these are the 8 or 9 guys I'm going with. And they're going to play. My main guys are going to play. Look, for Perth, their main guys played. Whether Tarico White was having a great series or not, whether Jesse Wagstaff was consistent or Plumlee was in foul trouble, whatever, they went with their main guys all the time.
Yeah, I mean, Cotton and Kay played well over 30. Even Tarico White played over 30 minutes a game. I think Bryce played 34, Kay about 32, maybe even higher in the finals exclusively, probably higher. But yeah, even Tarico White was having an odd series. He was 30 plus. I only think Casper Ware was the only king over 30. Yeah, really surprised. I like that G League analogy. I think that's whether that was his intention or subconsciously, I think that's the way it certainly looked on the floor with a lot of guys coming in and out a lot. It'd be really interesting. I don't think anyone asked him about what his rationale behind his rotations was. As a journalist and former, is that a cheeky question to ask as a journalist? Like, hey, why do you make subs?
No, it's not. It's a pertinent question to ask. A very pertinent question to ask. Just like you say, why was so-and-so on the floor at that particular time? What was your thinking? We just want to know what your thinking is. We're not necessarily being critical, but if you don't explain, if it looks like a bad move and you don't want to explain it, then you do look a little bit suspect. So you should be able, as a coach, you should be able to explain the moves you make without any hesitation. I know when I'm coaching, when I made a decision, if someone asked me afterwards, why did you do that? I would say, why I did that. You know, you've got to know. And so, no, I don't think that's a cheeky question. I think it's actually remiss of the journalists, especially those that are paid by news gathering organisations, not to ask. You've got to ask questions like that. Kevin Lish was kicking butt. Why was he sitting? Why did you think, or what were you looking for, the combination that you ran when he was sitting down? Brad Newley went for 16 points in quarter number two, I think, of game three. So where was he? How did he fall out of the second half rotation? These are questions that you certainly, the fans want to know. It's not like fans aren't looking at that and going, geez, we're making a lot of subs.
25 in the last quarter is a lot. To 9, it's a lot. It's more than double. And I know it was a garbage time. And if you got, but even if you subtract that stuff, and it was series long. Yeah, it was peculiar. I'd love to know his rationale. And maybe he's got a good one. I don't know.
Yes, exactly. And that's the other part of it, that perhaps he wants to explain it. Perhaps he'd like to say something to it, but no one's going to address it to him, and he's not going to bring it up because it's why are you going to bring up something that's touchy?
Yeah.
So, I think it's a very pertinent question, and it's not impertinent.
Hmm. Going back to the series, I mean, Sydney won that one game, right? I feel like you talked about the whistle in Perth in front of the crowd noise. I also felt like whoever was the aggressor in these games won. Perth were clearly the aggressor in game one, got the benefit of the whistle, and got the game. Game two, Bogut was just, he had a laser focus. He hasn't had all year. Like they were not, you said it in your article, I think, when he did that dunk, it was like, nah, not happening. Yep. And as a result, they got the calls in that game, even in Perth. I just felt like basketball is a game where if you have the ball and you put your head over it, you're going to win. Did you feel like that was what turned each winning game in this series, or did you see something else?
No, I agree with that. But I also think that the relevance of the lack of fans, the fact that there was no fans at games two and three, definitely would have impacted in some way. And it would have impacted more on the Wildcats in game two because they're just so used to 13,000 people on a consistent basis for past 6-7 years, every game, not just finals.
And Rabbit too,
And you take that out and it is different. It is different. Whereas Sydney going there, we've got to win this game. We've got to get back onto, we've dropped a set. We've got to get back on straight sets. So we've got to win this. So they're in there, as you say, laser focused. They're not concerned about anything except winning the game. Whereas the Wildcats, they got one in the bank. Now the fans aren't here. The reffing is a bit different. And they're on a back foot for most of that game. If you watched and saw Trevor Gleeson, he was a very frustrated coach, frustrated that his guys weren't really approaching it in the manner necessary to take a 2-0 lead, which they could have done, obviously. But they were not on the way they approached that game. Sydney absolutely had them. The triangle in two worked a treat, even though they'd worked it out by game three and took advantage of it. But in that particular scenario, Will Weaver did a great job, put something new in, and made an adjustment, and they struggled with that as well. I'm not sure that the playing the triangle in two with the two on Cotton and Tarico White was necessarily the right call, though, because White wasn't that imposing in this series. Nick Kay might have been a better option, but I don't know. I don't know how you, what the machinations are of a triangle and two when you're guarding. You know, when it's against two guards, because I saw it employed very successfully here in 1994 when Don Monson was coaching the 36ers, and the Melbourne Tigers were on their way to a championship. And they came into Adelaide on a Sunday game, and Andrew Gaze and Leonard Copeland were just tearing up the league at that particular moment. And Monson put in a triangle and two and just had the two defenders on Gaze and Copeland for the entire game. And they won comfortably. Melbourne just never really came to terms with that. But so it's easier when you're playing against a team that has two great guards.
Right.
So maybe that's why they went that way with Tirico White and Cotton, two smaller guys. Might be more difficult to work out, you know, where you're in the triangle, where you're not, when you've got a four or a five man involved in the two. So it was a good performance, a really good performance from them. They were, yeah, laser focused. I like that. They had a plan. They stuck to it. They were going to win. They were going home to Sydney. And I think Perth had some things working against them. But the thing I also liked, I think I already might have mentioned it, is that Perth won in front of a crowd in Sydney.
And without one.
Yeah, and that I think Sydney had a heck of an advantage in that game one, and it didn't pay off for them.
Perth would have taken this series to the planet Mars and played on its surface. I had every confidence they were going to win either game four or five, more than likely game four. Yes. They were prepared for it. Cheeky question. We can just
speculate that because that's all we can do. But I'm with you. I actually thought they'd win in four and maybe not Mars, maybe on Uranus.
Not enough room. But cheeky question. Did Trevor Gleeson outcoach Will Weaver in this series?
Oh, no question. No question.
Casper Ware, his struggles, what do you put them down to? He did not shoot well. I thought his defense on Cotton was good, and I just thought, let's stay with the planet motif. I thought that Casper Ware was still the second best point guard on the floor. It was just by a distance from Earth's yellow sun to the planet Pluto. Like, he was playing good defense. He wasn't hitting shots, but it just, the Cotton's cosmic gravity just swallowed up anyone and everyone, including Casper. What do you think?
Yeah, I tend to agree. But just before I answer that, did you ever wonder what sort of character Goofy was in Disney? Because you said Pluto. So Goofy had a dog called Pluto. And I always looked at
Goofy. He was a dog.
Goofy's the dog. So how does a dog have a dog? Anyway, just
one. And they were the same breed, I think, which is terrible. There might be some hierarchy we're not familiar with. I don't know.
Dog hierarchy. Okay. Look, I think Casper Ware, his focus had to be on Bryce Cotton. So we're detracting from his offense already, because his main focus in this series is to try and do a job on Bryce. Bryce has come into this grand final series averaging 33 points a game against Sydney in four regular season games. So someone has to get that assignment, and it fell to Casper. And I think his focus on that probably affected his offensive game more than he would have liked. But then we haven't seen a great offensive game from Casper in some time. So I'm starting to wonder whether the way the Sydney Kings run that group, whether that's as good for him as the Melbourne United scenario was, because he never struggled to this extent at any time. At United, you know, whether they were winning the championship over Adelaide or losing the championship to Perth, he didn't struggle in the way he struggled in this environment. And
one of
you
20
said,
or something? Crazy.
Yeah. Yep. But you just said a minute ago, when you're running through the minutes, that he played the most minutes. Now, you know, if you're going to say out of their first seven or eight, who was their worst contributor?
Casper.
It's Casper. So why is he playing those minutes? Put Lishan to the point. Maybe run Sean Bruce a little bit more, you know, try and get Casper, you know, out of the funk, because once he was mentally affected, clearly it was preying on his mind, because every time he missed a shot, his body language was distressed, and I'm trying to find it. I'm going to, you know, they're telling me to keep shooting. I'm going to keep shooting, but he's lost confidence in himself. He'd lost faith in himself. And perhaps, if you took the ball out of his hands and said, you know, Kevin Lish is going to carry, you just focus defending Bryce. And when the shot comes for you, take it. And if it doesn't, don't worry about it. Let sort of take some pressure off him, rather than say, keep shooting. You're a great shooter. Keep shooting. He didn't believe it anymore. He did not believe he's a great shooter. He'd lost that. He'd lost faith in himself. So just, you're just trying to be reinforcing positively, but really maybe take some pressure off him and say, mate, we don't need you to score 30. Relax, relax.
Yeah.
If you can keep Cotton down to 24, we'll be pretty happy with that. That'll help us win. But Newley and Lish and Kickett and Bogan, they'll pick up the slack. We've got plenty of talent going around, you know. So Tate, obviously, and Luzada, there's plenty of talent. In fact, they are by far the more talented team. So, segueing back to your previous question, yes, obviously Trevor Gleeson must have outcoached Will Weaver.
Mm-hmm. I think we saw with Mello Trimble where he went into a shooting slump, what happened? He came off the bench and that worked out really well for them and him. I think also during the season with the Kings, you saw a lot of sort of two-guard front, a lot of Casper Ware and a lot of Sean Bruce at the same time. And I don't really recall seeing a lot of it in this series. Maybe just pushing Casper off the ball a little bit, just ease the pressure and responsibility on him, maybe would have turned things. Hindsight, as I say. The other one is Taylor. I feel like if Deshaun Taylor was that third option to throw on Cotton so that Cotton gets no rest, because I really feel like Taylor had come a long way offensively, but defensively, I feel like he's the sort of, I mean, there's a lot of what-ifs with this series, and he may be the third what-if, but I really feel like if he had been there, Cotton may have been just a wee bit different. And maybe he trims 4 points off Cotton's game. That's enough to win a lot of these games, or maybe enough to win some of these games. So
it would have won the first game.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. Andrew Bogut, we saw him play well and then seem to struggle in the games on the close turnaround. Game three, he was quite good. I mean, two, he was amazing. And then three, just the body didn't – a couple of rebounding contests where he wasn't quite getting there.
Yep.
How did you see his body and, more importantly, going into next year? He's out of contract and also Tokyo. Actually, let's just go with next year in the NBL. Do you think he's returning? Did you like the look of his body?
Look, I felt in game one he was very, very good. And game two he was very good, but we had close to a week's break between one and two, right? Mm-hmm. And then, as you say, scrubbing up within 48 hours, getting that 7-foot body at 35 years old into an aeroplane and flying back to Sydney, he just didn't really have it, or didn't appear to have it in game three. So I don't know, maybe the rest is what he needs. Maybe if the Tokyo Olympics do not go ahead, and, you know, at this point there's question marks over everything, so we might as well not ignore that. If he was to get the break instead of having to sort of front up for the Boomers, then I think maybe he's got another good season in him. Yeah, absolutely. Mm.
What about going towards Tokyo and with the Olympics, let's say it does go ahead, the worry there is a lot of games, a lot of travel, very short schedule. His play is of the standard, but it's those extracurriculars that might hold him back. What do you think?
Yeah, well, they play every 48 hours. So then the Opals or the women play on the alternate nights. So it will be a tough ask of him. But tell me who you'd take in his place.
Oh. I mean, I think Nick Kay has to be on that team, and maybe that, if you include Landale and Bolden, I don't know. I don't know.
You know, I don't see it. See, I don't really see a centre there. I think you've just named a bunch of power forwards.
True.
And really, like, if you're saying who's another legit centre that we could take, I mean, Aaron Baines plays that
Baines
role.
Is him.
But after that, where do we go?
Yeah, no, you're right. He'll be there. I hope they do. I hope they retain a lot of that old team. The drops, buddy. A lot was said in the media about this Sydney Kings drops. Two-part question for you. Did you see that play out on the floor where you thought, uh-oh, Bryce Cotton is killing the analytics on that mid-range jump shot and the drops? And then also, did this series kind of have a narrative of the Wildcats are defying the mathematical, analytical push of basketball?
Yeah, because the Wildcats went about winning. Okay, you know, you can give me all the analytics you want and you can tell me what to eat and how much rest I need and, you know, what elevation I need my foot at overnight. But at the end of the day, I'm still a believer in your eyes, and I think Trevor Gleeson is a believer in his eyes. And he sees what's going on, and I don't think he falls in the trap of being overwhelmed by statistical information in a world that loves statistical information.
Do love the stats. I must admit.
Yeah,
especially as they pertain to Titanic.
Your favorite movie. You know what? You should switch to Sound of Music. I reckon that's a fairly long film,
too. You know, next season, it'll be something else, I promise.
Okay. But no, I'm old school, I must admit. And I look at the analytics with some interest because, often they will throw something up that is very curious and interesting. But, you know, when I was coaching and they handed me the stat sheet at the end of each quarter, I just handed it to my assistant and would say, you know, just see if there's anything on there that's worth making a note of, like, oh, we didn't notice, but so-and-so from the other team got 26 points in that quarter. Ooh, you know, I should have noticed. But, you know, if I hadn't noticed that with my eyes, you know, then there's something wrong with me. That's what you're there for. So I think we have coaches now that are a little bit insecure at times, surround themselves with 25 assistants. Let's have everyone's opinion. Let's talk it through. Let's coach by community. And, you know, I don't think that's the way to success. I think Trevor Gleeson, Joey Wright, you can keep going through those guys that just make the call on what they see and what they feel and what right. and their instincts. And I think instinct is still more important than analytics. That's not to say analytics aren't relevant. I'm just saying your instincts are better.
I'd actually compare it to like guys who play music, right? Paul McCartney cannot read or write sheet music. The Beatles made some pretty good songs. Miles Davis didn't write sheet music, make some music. I think analytics are a good way to say, we tried to do this. Here was our rationale. And you can put your hands up and say, hey, look, we put it into the numbers, you know? Yeah. And it actually mirrors sort of like a Robert McNamara, sort of early 70s, late 60s, if you remember what was going on there.
I'm still thinking about Stevie Wonder not writing sheet music.
Oh, did he not write music either? Well, there you go. Like best.
There's a reason for that.
That went over my. I didn't see that coming. Pardon the fuck. Of course he did. But yeah, so you know, there's that element of at one point or another, you kind of have to look at that stuff, certainly. But yeah, not trust yourself. What was I going to say? Bryce Cotton. Talk of him being best ever and things. I never saw Leroy. I've been going back and having a look at a couple of his games. I saw a decent amount of Ricky Grace. What would be the deficiency of Cotton in his game up against those three? Like Leroy's the sort of length.
Nothing at all, just longevity. Okay, he's been here, what, three seasons? Yeah, three and a half seasons? Yeah. I mean, Leroy in the 80s, I think it was 82, 83, 84, 85, 86, 87. The title went through Leroy. Nowadays, you've got to go through Perth. But in the 80s, to win the championship, you had to go through Leroy Loggins and whoever he was playing for. West Adelaide for two of those years, Brisbane for the rest of them. And that's what marks him as the champion. I'm not sure they were giving out MVPs for the grand final on a regular basis, but he would have been winning it. Yeah. And he was a three-time winner of the league MVP award. And he didn't have his dad voting for him. So the truth of it is Leroy is on a pedestal, and rightly so. Now, Bryce Cotton is a fabulous.
What about Ricky? Before you do Bryce, what about Ricky? Like, what did you think about his game from, like, Leroy to me was a guy who seems to be a hatchet man, did it all. Ricky, more the cerebral point guard, got everyone involved, just the ultimate orchestrator, whereas Bryce is just a punch-in-the-mouth scorer. Would that be a fair distinction of the three?
Yeah. Look, I'd have Ricky without any question in our all-time greats. No question at all. Not even a debate. Not even a discussion point. Terrific player. And everywhere he went, Perth enjoyed success. If he was healthy, they were in the championship running. If he was unhealthy, they were just going to make the playoffs. So he was... You know, he had flaws in his game, I had a conversation with him once. I said to him, you know, I said, you don't have any right hand. You're Ricky Grace. You go leftest, and everybody knows it. And he just laughed at me and said, doesn't matter that everybody knows it, they still can't stop it. Yeah, and he's right. He was right. He was a fantastic player. He could beat you with his shot. He could beat you with his playmaking. You know, he was a defender. He did everything. He was a fantastic basketball player. And I would say probably the number one Wildcat to this point.
Yes.
But he was also a facilitator. And as a result of that, he didn't win a lot of MVP awards for the league. In fact, none. He won a bunch of...
Finals MVPs, but no MVPs, you're very right.
Yeah, and the Wildcats Club MVP. He won that, I think it was the Gordon Ellis Trophy. I think he's won that a few times. But because the Wildcats respected what he brought. Now... Bryce Cotton conversation is completely different. A lot of the people that say, oh, Bryce Cotton is the greatest ever, they've been here for 5 minutes. If you said to them, well, what do you think Rocky Smith's strengths were? They wouldn't even know who you're talking about. Well, what about Robert Rose? What did you think of him? I don't know. Robert Rose? I don't, oh, no. Well, Bryce Cotton's the best. But because we get a little bit caught up on the last 5 minutes. You know, and if you look across the whole thing, Bryce Cotton is definitely going to finish in our top three or four players of all time if he maintains what he's doing for another couple of years. Longevity is what will get him in the absolute recognition of the basketball public far and wide, as opposed to a few people in there that just want to, you know, grab headlines and clickbait and whatever else.
Right.
Okay. I have no doubt that Bryce will get there. He has the game. He's just phenomenal. They tried everything to stop him. And, you know, the best they could do was hold him to 27. And, you know, if you or I got 27, we'd be pretty bloody happy.
Yeah. I'll ask you this question. Let's say you were given the reins of a team. Let's call it the Alice Springs. Springs.
Alice Springs. What about Perth Bandits?
Let's go Perth Bandits. Perth Bandits.
Let's go with Perth Bandits.
Perth Bandits. All right, they're going to love this. They tap you on the shoulder and they say, buddy, we want you to be the GM. You've got a historical draft. You can take anyone you want. Our main focus is winning the whole damn thing, which is the player you take to ensure or do the best job you can to ensure that that team wins from any player ever. Is Leroy your answer?
In their prime?
In their prime.
Okay. It's a very, very tough call then between Leroy Loggins and Ken Richardson, who is the inaugural MVP of the league and probably should be in the Hall of Fame, but because – you know, like a lot of players had their careers in the 70s and then the league started in 79 and there were guys then that were like 28, 29 years old. So they only played 2 or 3 years in the league, enough to make an impact, but not enough to be recognized in the longer term. And Ken was a 6'6", 6'7". He was kind of hunched over, power forward, center, just a phenomenal player who could do it all and did, and was just brilliant with his defensive rebound, touchdown pass for a layup. When he played together with Leroy, when he recruited Leroy to West Adelaide, that West Adelaide team of 1982 was one of the most underrated teams of all time. But it was the first team that had three MVPs in it, in Ken, Leroy and Al Green, not to mention a couple of Olympians in Peter Ali and Brad Dalton. It was a very deep and very good team. And Ken in his prime just did so many little things, but I think ultimately I'd take Leroy over him because Leroy not only gave you everything or anything you needed to win, whatever it was, whether it was a 3-point shot, a dunk, a steal, blocking a shot, stopping a player, making a super pass, whatever it took to win that game, Leroy would come up with it. So on that basis, yeah, you start from Leroy and then you work out from him.
I mean, I just love Cotton so much. I just think he's almost like the Mickey Mantle of basketball. Mickey Mantle got hits and home runs. Cotton just scores. And this is an offensive game. Game favors the offense. And yes, he's just ridiculous. So I'm going to go back. I'm going to watch a lot more Leroy and Rocky Smith and if I can get my hands on tape and have a look at him. Question your buddy, Cotton. What keeps him out of the NBA more, in your opinion? The sort of his deficiencies in his game or his athleticism or his size or the sort of behind the scenes BS that have contracts, draft order, reputation. Do you think which one keeps him out?
The latter. The latter. There's really no physical reason that he can't play NBA. You've seen him, you've watched him. He's a phenomenal.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, he's better. You could just sit there now if you wanted to and scratch your head and then spew out a bunch of names of players in the NBA that he's better than. So then it comes down to a question of right place, right time, political motivations, what a team needed that he was maybe in the wrong environment. Yeah, for what that team needed. You know, it's the NBA is a little bit about luck. You know, you look at the Joe Ingles example. You know, he was cut by the Clippers and was just about to come home, and he gets thrown a bit of a lifeline by Utah Jazz, who really just want him there to babysit Dante Exum. And turns out Dante Exum's gone, and Joe Ingles is one of the most prominent players in that environment. Now, right environment, right circumstance, he made the most of it. Great, but you know, he could have gone to 28 other teams other than the Clippers, and lasted 10 days. So I think Bryce should be getting another shot. Absolutely, should be getting another shot at the NBA. But frankly, their loss is our gain.
Oh, yeah, so, no doubt about it. I think also, I mean, teams are clamoring for the likes of LaMelo Ball and RJ Hampton, throwing games to get a high draft pick, to take these kids. And I think it's odd because even from a business standpoint, okay, let's say you take LaMelo Ball, he's 6 years off prime before he gets stronger and improves the shot and so on and so forth to get to Bryce Cotton's level. He came in this league. He was good. He was very good. But he wasn't Bryce Cotton. He wasn't even close. So I find it odd that teams are clamoring to give this kid, you know, the rookie contract's about 4 years at about four or five mil, so 20 mil plus whatever else to mature him to perform when you could give Cotton one or two US million and you've got a ready-made brilliant player. I find it's a very odd economy of the NBA, but the draft prestige. I mean, we had a number of guys in the NBA, NBL this season who've been drafted by NBA teams, ATM Ajuk of the Breakers being one of them by the Lakers many, many years ago. So, and we talked about Utah, like it's an odd situation where Cotton goes to Utah and there's, and it's actually, I read an article interestingly the other day that apparently in a sort of draft tryout for the NBA, Cotton went up against Scotty Wilbekin and Wilbekin defended him really well. And scouts saw that and thought, oh, he's going to struggle with size. So it's funny how this little NBL and Australian fraternity has played out with Cotton and the league. And it's a, and then he goes to Utah where there's Exum, where there's Ingles. It's just, it's a small world after all.
Yeah, but, you know, often when you come and you play in the NBL and you're actually allowed to be who you could be,
right.
you're not pigeonholed into you're this or that. You know, we want you in a corner shooting threes or we want you doing this. Or you know, you're not pigeonholed in the NBL. You get a chance to play basketball. You know, I mean, you know, perhaps I've forgotten his name now, the guy that played for Southeast Melbourne, the big guy that they eventually cut.
Benson.
And then a lot. Yeah, you know, well, maybe he was pigeonholed. But realistically, guys that come here, and it happens in the WNBL as well. We get WNBA players who come here, like a Kelsey Griffin, who couldn't get much court time over there. She comes and plays for Bendigo for a couple of years and just blossoms into the best player she can be, goes back there and is kicking butt in the WNBA. Mm. You know, Lindsay Allen, kicking butt in the WNBA. So sometimes it takes our environment to release the best in a player to where they feel like they can confidently try whatever they want to do. And then, wow, we see them in a way that the NBA has never seen them. Because perhaps in their college environment, once again, they were pigeonholed and had to do a particular role. Now they get to the NBA environment and sorry, you're too short, or you're this or you're that. They come out here and they're allowed to blossom. I mean, James Ennis blossomed.
Blossomed.
Absolutely.
Amazing. Did they show that? Yeah.
So I think, we're seeing the best of Bryson now. I think if the NBA looked at him again, I fear we will lose him.
Yeah, I agree. And it's just a conversation of Division One, Division Two colleges. You look at all the players out of Metro State, and Worthington's had this conversation. They just seem to flourish as players, like Wagstaff. Look, Nick Kay, most prominent among them, like just a guy who you wouldn't look at and go, oh, but has expanded his game and learnt how to sort of build on his game, which is really good.
Hang on, there's a misconception about Division One and Division Two, because in our minds, Division One is the better division, Division Two is the second best, Division Three, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But it's not based on that. It's based on how many students you have at your college. That's what it's based on. So if you've got 10,000 at your college and I've got 2,000 in mine, chances of me coming up with a competitive team against yours are pretty small. So I now play Division Two, but I might still have some great players and some great teams. So that's Leroy Loggins. I think he came from a Division Two school and he just turned into an absolute megastar.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. It's about building on your game. Last thing for you, buddy.
Last one.
The article I told you about the financial losses that is expected. I haven't run those numbers yet. What was your initial reaction to that article?
Surprise that we're still in the same boat cycle. The same cycle of spending money that at some point an owner's going to go, geez, I'm actually losing a bit of money here. I mean, every new owner thinks they're going to reinvent the wheel and turn it into a win. But to see that Australian article, they're saying that we're 30 million in the red.
15 to 20.
I'm projecting another 5 years. you know, it's disturbing for sure. Because, like I said, every owner comes in thinking, you know, I can make this work. And then the harsh reality is that a lot of people have tried and failed. So it's disturbing. It really is disturbing. And I don't I don't really know how much Larry Kesselman is prepared to just keep putting into it until he sees some sort of return. Where do you think the revenue return would come from? Selling the television rights, getting to that point where people actually want to fight for the TV rights? Is that where we'll get the money?
I don't know. I think the big question I have is, does a game between Perth, and we saw this, does a game between Perth and Cairns have national appeal? 11,000 people watched game one of that series. I don't think it does. Mm-hmm. So that's the thing. Does it have, like, but then does Carlton playing Richmond have appeal in Perth? Again, I don't know.
Well, it probably does. Maybe St Kilda playing Greater Western Sydney has no appeal in Brisbane. Yeah, good point.
It's an interesting thing. So maybe local TV, I really don't know. I mean, I'm not coming up with a business. If someone hasn't come up with it by now, I'm not going to be the one to do it. But, yeah, interesting. I think it's where the sport sits. The question I kind of have for you is, in the 90s when it was popular, like, did the popularity of this league die with Andrew Gaze? Like, or the profitability?
Ooh, no. The football stepped in. Right. That's what happened. We made some outlandish claims. Mal Speed, who was the chairman of the NBL at the time, said that, you know, by the 1990s we'd be the number one sport, or some crazy stuff like that, or by the turn of the century. And football started to take notice, as in AFL football started to take a little bit of notice of this little upstart basketball. And then things like Michael Jordan being the most popular sportsman among Australian kids. Not Alan Border, who was the test captain at the time, or someone, you know. And I think media generally was a bit startled by this upstart basketball, and football just went from pretty much 2:20 on a Saturday afternoon, that's when games used to start, to suddenly they're playing Friday nights, Saturday afternoon, Saturday evening, Saturday night, Sunday matinee.
But then wouldn't the move to summer counter that?
That was the belief, but the premise on which the league moved to summer was on the understanding that television would then jump aboard, because somebody from the league had a conversation from somebody at Channel 7 who'd said, oh yeah, if you guys were in summer, we'd be all over it. So they moved without any commitment, without anything in writing. They made the move, and guess what? TV didn't jump on.
Do you feel that was a malice thing where they sort of said, oh, yeah, well, and then, yep, yoink, now that you've changed, like, we've got you, sucker.
Well, if you look at the network involved, it was the network that was involved with football.
Touche. Could be interesting. Yeah, I don't know what the model is. I just think, yeah, I don't know. Last thing, I've got a joke for you. Do you remember Karnak the Magnificent body?
Oh, no.
Johnny Carson, you don't know the...
Oh, you know, is that where he used to put the envelope against his forehead? And yes,
I might cut this out because I don't know if this is mean spirited or not. But I'm gonna do a little Karnak and see if I like it. All right, so I'll do the three things. Here we go: Cheech and Chong, the depths of the Mariana Trench, and the coronavirus death rate of 0.1% in 15 to 44-year-olds. Open envelope. Name three things higher than Casper Ware's shooting percentage.
Oh, wow.
Probably cut it. I don't know. That's a bit harsh. Poor guy. Didn't happen for him.
Look, I tell you what. If I was making a team right now, he'd still be one of the first players I pick.
Totally.
I mean, you've just got to get him in the right environment and approach him the correct way. For as many good things as Will Weaver did this year, and going back early into the season, what he was drawing out of Craig Moller and Sean Bruce as two guys that really had been around a bit and not really wanted, not greatly coveted by other clubs, what he got out of them was pretty phenomenal. He reignited Brad Newley's career. I thought last season Brad was heading towards retirement. And instead we got probably his best season out of the four he's played at the Sydney Kings. So there were a lot of good things that happened. And unfortunately, Casper falling away was not one of them. And I don't think they handled that well to get him back to who he is and who he could be.
Yeah, he's a stud. And I think he's got a year where he's going to sort of take a hit, get humbled, and maybe lose a few bucks, because I think he's signed a one-year deal. But come back and...
be interesting to see if he changes situation, but there's plenty of fuel in his tank. He's a great player, and he was coming up. He was coming up against Bryce Cotton. These things happen.
Yeah, Cotton, who's going to be recognised as the best player of his generation here, and possibly the best player in the league ultimately.
He's fantastic, Barty. That's all I have for you. Pleasure.
It's been a pleasure as always.